I've got a question for you. Can you name the United States' only UNESCO City of Literature?
No, I cannot.
There could be somewhere old. Like an old place.
Ooh. Can I loan a friend?
We asked this question to the people of Iowa City, and there were some pretty good guesses.
City of Literature? Seattle.
I don't know, maybe Indianapolis?
I'm guessing the capital?
Hi, I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Anna Williams.
And this is Lit City, an Iowa Public Radio podcast created right here in the City of Literature.
It's not Iowa City, is it? It is? Really? Wow. Okay.
This podcast highlights some of the year's best fiction and nonfiction by presenting Charity's interviews with all kinds of authors. We'll also share some of our thoughts on those books and feature some glimpses into the sights, sounds, and history of Iowa City's literary landscape.
So we're going to start off with a conversation I had with Nathan Hill back in October. This was shortly after his debut novel had been released, and he'd already been compared to the novelist John Irving. John Irving compared him to Charles Dickens. Expectations were very high. The book is called The Nix, N-I-X, and it's hard to say what it's about. It's about love, loss, secrets, politics, video game addiction, academia, and Norwegian folklore. The character at the center of it all, Samuel Anderson Anderson, does bear a passing resemblance with his creator. Nathan Hill was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and he majored in English and journalism at the University of Iowa. But that was quite a while ago. He now lives in Naples, Florida, and I spoke with him when he was in the midst of his book tour. Nathan, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for the invitation. I'm happy to do it.
Well, can you introduce us a little bit to this character, Samuel Anderson Anderson, who, as I mentioned, does share a few autobiographical details with you, but this is a work of fiction, and you've made that very clear. But tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, I've had to tell my former employers that it's definitely a work of fiction because, like me, Samuel is or was an English teacher, a professor of English at a university who teaches freshman composition. So those classes, you know, freshmen take them and they learn how to write an essay in college. Now, that's what I did for a living for 9 or 10 years. And I gave Samuel that same job. But Samuel hates it. He hates it quite a lot more than I ever did. I actually like teaching quite a lot, but that doesn't make for very good drama. So Samuel is in a pretty bad place. He resents his students. He resents his lack of success as a writer. And he spends most of his time with a video game called World of Elfscape. It's basically my ripoff of World of Warcraft.
And he is quickly approaching, although he doesn't quite know it yet, a major... actually, like 6 major crises in his life all at the same time. And we won't give anything away. But I'm curious. I know that this is a novel that kind of grew organically for you over time. And one of your original impetuses was to write a novel about politics. And there are certainly politics in this novel. But tell me a little bit about the journey you took from politics to this kind of 600-page epic.
I started writing the book in 2004, and the first impulse was I'd moved to New York City in August 2004, and I had gone down to watch the protests at the Republican National Convention at Madison Square Garden. And that was where the first ideas came from. People were pretty angry. This was Bush Cheney's second term. They were protesting the war in Iraq, and I had the idea to write about somebody at that protest. And I was a young man. I was in my mid late 20s at the time, very politically aggressive, and I thought I would write this really heavy handed political novel. And thank goodness I gave that up eventually. Because as I kept looking into some of the things that I was writing about, I realized it's probably obvious to anybody, but to me, I was so naive. I realized I really had no idea what I was talking about. Like, what were the odds that that from my very limited point of view, I had the capital T truth about American politics? So instead, I gave up on writing some sanctimonious novel, and instead I became much more interested in the ways that we as individuals sort of glance off of historical or political movements. And so that gave me the idea of maybe I should place these people, my characters, in moments in political history. So Occupy Wall Street, the 2004 convention, the 1968 convention in Chicago, but not necessarily as a way to say, like, this person's right and this person's wrong, but much more just as an investigation to the kind of abstract relationship we have with politics throughout our lives.
The political thread does continue through the book, not just historically, but in a contemporary way, although it takes place in the summer of 2011. There is this character in the book, Governor Packer, who is a Tea Party type Republican candidate, and he's sort of testing the waters for a presidential run. And a lot of the rhetoric that he uses sounds a lot like the kind of rhetoric that we've been hearing a lot of over the last couple of years. Were you concerned at any point that your political satire was being outstripped by real life?
It's pretty weird, right? Yeah, I had to go back into my notebooks, because enough people had asked me about the Packer character. I had to look back in my notebooks. I wrote that guy something like 8 years ago. That scene at the beginning was written about 8 years ago now. So I certainly didn't model him on real life. But the fact that everybody is saying, like, oh, you must have written that to reflect the current political season, just seems it's an obvious example of reality becoming much weirder than fiction very quickly.
There are so many different elements in this novel that give us insight. And again, I mean, you're pushing the envelope on a lot of these to the point of satire, but there's still a lot of truth in what you're writing. There are so many different elements of different parts of life, with academics and politics and love and relationships and the protest movement. You write about a couple of different protest movements and the publishing world and all of these different things. You have kind of, it almost seems like an agenda that you want to share on each of these subjects that is voiced by your different characters. Were there different things that were sort of competing to get out there when you were writing the novel?
It's funny. Some of the stuff that people are calling satire is just reality with a different name. You know, sometimes reality is just so silly that you just give it a slightly different name and you can see how ridiculous it is. For example, somebody in the book is starting a new diet. It's called the Pleisto diet, and it's they eat only foods that people ate in the Pleistocene, specifically the Taurantian epoch during the last ice age. And that's just very slightly different from what actually exists in the world. Similarly, Laura, the student you were talking about, is obsessed with a social media app called I Feel, where she gets to broadcast her emotions to her friends, and then her friends can then select to respond, ignore, or auto care, and most of them just auto care, and that is also not that different from just clicking a like button on Facebook. So, yeah, there's a lot of satire, but it's also I feel like I'm cheating because I'm not really changing that much. I'm just kind of presenting some of the things we already do, myself included, but you just give it a slightly different name. And suddenly sometimes you can see the absurdity of it.
Well, it also made me think that the novel will have at least a longer life maybe because of that too, because you refer to a lot of things that I'm very familiar with, but you do it sort of in a sideways way where you are giving it a little bit different name. And of course, right now I can think exactly what you're talking about with World of Warcraft or Facebook or whatever it is. But in 10 years, it'll be something else that resonates with people in that exact same way.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was hoping it would have somewhat of a shelf life, but mostly, especially with the Warcraft thing, I needed to change the name because I just did not want to be beholden to that fan base. Like, they are militant, you know, with their and extraordinarily knowledgeable about their subject. So I needed my video game to be a little more flexible than they would have allowed.
Well, and let's talk about video games a little bit. Are you a gamer yourself?
So, yeah, it's funny. I have a sort of love-hate relationship with gaming. On the one hand, It's a whole lot of fun. I met a lot of people, a lot of very cool people gaming, and it sort of got me through a bit of a dark time in my life. You know, I had just gotten out of school. I really didn't know what I was doing in my career. I wasn't making any money. Like a month after moving to New York City, all of my things were stolen. So I literally had nothing. But
and including your computer, your hard drive that had everything you'd written on it.
Exactly.
Right?
So I had to start over, and so I was really, really depressed. And so it was very easy to feel like completely out of control in my life. But a friend of mine got me hooked on this video game, and in that realm, I felt very in control. In that realm, I felt like very powerful. You know, very. I was very successful there, whereas I wasn't very successful in the rest of life. So it got me through a tough time. But you know, fast forward 3 years, and I started resenting how much time the game was taking me away from my real life, and I eventually had to give it up when I realized I was gaming more than writing. And so that was about 2007, and unsurprisingly, the writing in the novel took off right around that time.
Well, speaking of writing and gaming getting in the way of it, that's something that, again, you share with the main character, Samuel Anderson. But there's another character in the book, and we never even learn his real name. We know his screen name, Pwnage. But he plays a pivotal role in the book, and he also has an extreme video game addiction. I would love for you to read from a little bit from the chapter where we really learn at least a little bit about Pwnage and his life.
Sure, this is where Pwnage first starts, first appears, and he has been playing the world of Elfscape all day. He hadn't intended to play the game today. He certainly hadn't intended to play as long as he did. Today was supposed to be the first day of his new diet. Today was the day he had vowed to start eating better. Fruits and vegetables and lean proteins and no trans fats and nothing processed and reasonable portions and carefully balanced meals of huge nutritional abundance beginning today. And he launched his brand new eating better lifestyle that very morning by cracking open a Brazil nut and chewing it and swallowing it, because Brazil nuts were one of the top 5 foods you're not eating enough of, according to the diet book he bought in preparation for today, along with the diet book sequel books and the diet's associated meal plans and mobile device apps, all of which advocated a cuisine made up largely of animal proteins and nuts, basically hunter-gatherer. And he thought about all the heart-healthy good fats and antioxidants and metanutrients inside the Brazil nut pouring through his own body, doing helpful things like zapping free radicals and lowering his cholesterol and hopefully strengthening his energy levels, because there was so much to do. The kitchen urgently needed renovation. The countertop laminate was cracking and curling at the edges, and the dishwasher stopped working last spring, and the garbage disposal died maybe a year ago, and 3 of the 4 burners on the stove were useless, and the refrigerator had lately gone insane. The fridge side shutting down unpredictably and spoiling hot dogs and lunch meats and souring milk, while the freezer side occasionally went hyperactive and locked all his TV dinners in permafrost. Also, the kitchen cabinets needed to be cleared of various plastic collections of Tupperware gone yellow with age, and the forgotten bags of dried fruit or nuts or potato chips, and the many small cylindrical containers of herbs and spices arranged in geologic layers formed by his previous attempts to start new diets, each attempt requiring the purchase of whole new sets of herbs and spices, because in the time elapsed since the last serious attempt, the old herbs and spices fused within their jars into single, unusable, dehydrated chunks. And he knew he should open up all the cabinets and throw everything away and make sure there were no colonies of bacteria or bugs living in the farthest, darkest back corners. But he didn't really want to open the cabinets and check for bugs, because he was afraid of what he might find, namely bugs. Because then he'd have to put up plastic and fumigate and clear space elsewhere to create a kind of staging area in which to pile the necessary parts, the new cabinetry and planks for the hardwood flooring and the new appliances and the various hammers, saws, boxes of nails, screws, PVC pipes, and other things necessary for drastic kitchen reconstruction. Though, looking around the house, he understood how difficult this was going to be. The living room, for example, had to be a no-construction debris zone in case some evening in the future he found himself entertaining unexpected guests, meaning Lisa. who would not find heaps of tools inviting or romantic. Same with the bedroom, also a bad staging area choice for exactly the same reason, though admittedly it had been quite a while since Lisa had come over, mostly because she insisted they maintain their distance during this new phase of their relationship, an edict that did not stop her from asking for rides to work and to various mini malls to complete various errands, and just because Lisa had divorced him didn't mean he would let her hang high and dry without a driver's license and a car, and while he knew most guys would do exactly that, he was just raised differently.
That's Nathan Hill reading from his new novel, The Knicks, and that was the character Pwnage, who has a serious video game addiction. But while I wanted to feel superior to Pwnage in reading that chapter and feel like, oh my gosh, here's a guy with a terrible problem, the kind of problem I could never experience, I think it's really easy to see yourself, or at least it was for me, to see myself in him, because we all have those goals that we think about and maybe even make a plan, but just get in our own way when we try to accomplish them. And I was really struck by how human, likable, and sympathetic this extreme character was.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, he started as a sort of joke, and then I realized that I was doing so much, so many of the things that that he also does. I mean, the thing about Pwnage is something that we all experience, which is that he thinks that he is going to be sometime in the future a way better person than he is right now. And I think we all do that to a degree, right? I mean, we get gym memberships and then maybe rarely go, or we load up our Netflix queue with like deep, heavy Oscar winners, and then on a day-to-day basis find ourselves watching, I don't know, Iron Man or something. And we think, in the future, we're going to finally start that diet, or finally stop playing video games, or renovate the kitchen. But on a day-to-day basis, what's most easy to do is for Pwnage, he'll start playing Elfscape again. And I think to a degree, we all sort of do that. We hope that we're going to be better people, but when it really comes down to it, in the very small, tiny day-to-day choices, it's actually very, very difficult to be as good as we want to be.
Well, and one of the things that I really loved about Pwnage is how he's so incredibly hopeless in his own life, but he's very skilled in World of Elfscape. And then there comes a time when he can offer advice and counsel to Samuel, the main character of the book, and it's brilliant advice. I mean, it just breaks down a problem and makes it solvable in a way that it hadn't been before, and he used video game logic to get there.
Yeah, his whole philosophy of life is based on the four challenges that one faces in a video game. And the four challenges are enemies, obstacles, puzzles, and traps. And so he thinks that any problem, or really any person you encounter in life, is one of those four things: an enemy, obstacle, puzzle, or trap. So if they're an enemy, you just have to eliminate them in somehow. If they're an obstacle, you have to find your way around them. The problem is between the puzzle and the trap. As he says at one point, sometimes it's hard to tell those apart. You think something's a puzzle until you realize it's a trap, but by then it's too late. That's the trap.
Well, and that's really sound advice, at least in this scenario it was. But do you feel like maybe you do gain some ability to reason and solve logical problems by playing video games?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I know that when I was like in fourth grade and begging my parents for Nintendo, I made some really silly argument about hand-eye coordination that they totally did not buy.
I remember that one, yeah.
I don't know. I think with his philosophy, it's not that the people themselves could be, let's say, enemies or puzzles or obstacles or traps. It's how we choose to see them. In a way, you know, we have some degree of choice and control over this. So you can be a person who sees everybody else as an enemy, and indeed a lot of the characters at the beginning of the novel do just that. But it takes a kind of radical act of will, but it's also possible to see those same people as puzzles, and not necessarily as enemies, but rather as things to solve, things to figure out. And I hope that the argument of the book is that doing that, it creates a life that's much less punishing and much less toxic than constantly thinking you're surrounded by enemies.
The main character, Samuel Anderson Anderson, is a writer, and he is really stuck in his career. And one of the big reasons that he's stuck is because he has been writing to a very specific audience. He's been trying to impress a girl ever since he started writing. And he can't seem to get past writing and shaping his writing based on what she will think of him. But that's something a lot of writers experience. The idea of the audience for the writing getting in the way of the creation of the writing. Was that something that you experienced early on?
Sure. When I first moved to New York, I was right out of grad school, and I moved there with a few writer friends that were colleagues of mine in my program. And I remember one of them saying something like, you know, we have a couple years to make it big or else we're just another washed up MFA-er. And I was dumb enough and naive enough at the time to take that seriously. And I was like, I don't want to be a washed up MFA-er. And besides, I just, you know, gone into a little bit of debt, getting an MFA in creative writing. I told my parents I was doing this crazy thing, and so now is the time to prove that I was right about it. And so I started writing these stories that in hindsight I was writing them for all the wrong reasons. You know, I was trying to place them in certain tiers of journals so I could get the attention of agents and editors and get good things on my CV to get a good teaching job somewhere. And it was just, they were all just like widgets to try to help me get what I want. And so, unsurprisingly, the stories were very bad. And so it wasn't until I sort of gave up all of that and stopped querying and stopped sending stuff out and stopped worrying about it so much that the novel really sort of took off on me, and I got to sort of imbue the book with a lot of the anxiety that I had been feeling. I gave it all to Samuel, who really resents that he'd never lived up to his potential.
Now, speaking of experiences not living up to potential, there are many moments in the book where characters have an opportunity to learn something and mature and hopefully go on and become happier individuals. And almost all of your characters blow opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to grow and learn. Is there some cynicism that you carry about the human ability to grow and learn?
I hope not, because I feel like I don't want to say it's a happy ending, but I feel like they're in a much better place by the end of the novel, certainly than they were at the beginning. I think it's not necessarily cynicism. In fact, I hope that I forgive them their foibles, as I hope that anybody would forgive me with the mistakes I've made in my past. I think it's really easy when we're faced in one of those decisions where maybe we can grow and become a better person. It's very easy to be selfish about that, to be sort of tunnel vision-y, to not see it for what it is at the time, and then later to internalize your decision and make it seem to yourself like, no, that was the right thing to do. And, you know, we always want to be the good guy in the story of our own lives, you know? And so I think it's really easy to not be critical and not grow.
Assume you're the good guy all along.
Exactly. And so I hope that it doesn't come off as cynicism so much as just, when you step back and you really evaluate yourself, like, do so in such a way that you don't assume that you're right all the time. And I think that's what the characters finally figure out somewhere near the end of the book.
I want to talk about Iowa before we run out of time, because that's something else that you share, again, with this main character. He was born in Iowa, and he returns to his hometown in Iowa, which is just this lovely blend of a lot of familiar things to anybody who's spent any time in Iowa. There's a lot of Cedar Rapids, but it's also a river town on the Mississippi. What was your inspiration? What towns did you spend a lot of time in?
Well, you've nailed them already. Yeah. So my extended family were farmers and outside of Clinton, Iowa, and then my mom grew up in Comanche, Iowa. I was born in Cedar Rapids and then lived in Comanche and Clinton for a few years and then moved to Des Moines. And so, a lot of the descriptions are blends of a lot of those places, those landscapes and those landscapes that I really love, and they feel at home for me. I would spend growing up, my family moved away from Iowa, and we kind of bopped around the country a bit. But growing up, I would always come back to the farm every summer. And so I feel like coming back to Iowa City for college, it just felt like coming back home again.
There's this thread of Norwegian folklore that goes through the book. That's where the title of the book, The Nix, comes from. And there are, of course, a lot of people in Iowa who are of Norwegian descent. Is that something else you share?
Sure. So on my mother's side, my three or four generations back, moved from Norway to a little town in Minnesota. And then after spending, maybe roughly 10, 15, 20 years in Minnesota, moved to Iowa. And so yeah, my mom's side is Norwegian. But we don't have much contact with, or any, I should say, we don't have any contact with that part of the family. That line just kind of evaporated. So I always knew it was part of my family's history, but we didn't have any information about it. And so in this book, I go back to Norway, and it was almost as if it was my opportunity to invent the family history that I don't actually have.
Oh, interesting. Well, as you're traveling around the country on your book tour, what is it like to be face to face with your readers, that imagined audience that you've been writing to for so many years?
Oh, it's so cool. People have come out. I think the Q&A after a reading is probably my favorite part, because, people who, a lot of whom have read the book, get to ask me all these questions. I love hearing what people are drawn to. Their favorite parts of the book are not necessarily my favorite parts of the book. And that's really cool. The contact with readers at bookstores, but also the emails I've been getting. I'll tell you my favorite letter so far came from someone. It was just three sentences long. I memorized the whole thing. It said, "Dear Nathan Hill, I am very old. I have read a lot of books, and yours is among my favorite. Please don't take 10 years writing the next one. I'm 83." So, it's like, that is amazing. How can you not love that?
The ultimate vote of confidence. And there's some pressure there. You don't want to disappoint.
I wrote this person back immediately and said I'd be working really hard.
Nathan Hill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Nathan Hill. He is the author of The Nix, and that's an interview I recorded with him back in October of 2016. And before the novel came out, a lot of people were comparing him to John Irving. I'm a huge John Irving fan, so for me, that raised my expectations sky high. And it really lived up to it for me. I really enjoyed the book. It was sort of an Irving-esque, long, convoluted plot, and the characters were developed really well. I really loved that, and I particularly enjoyed the women characters.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, Charity. And one thing that I really noticed after finishing the book is that so many of the major plot points are set in motion by women's issues. And I think that at the heart of this novel, it's really kind of a feminist novel. The main conflict is Samuel's relationship with his mother, Faye, who is a character that, as Nathan Hill said, glances off of this historical movement, the women's movement of the 1960s, in all of these different ways. And you really gain sympathy for her by the end of the novel.
And when you start, you don't think you're going to have any sympathy for her whatsoever.
Right. What gives you sympathy is realizing that she was the victim of all these terrible things that happened to her during the women's movement of the 60s at the hands of men.
One of the interesting things that I found about reading the book was that there is all this satire throughout the novel, but the satire feels like it's supposed to be so over the top. But there's just this ring of truth. And so you feel really uncomfortable because it's too real.
But what were you thinking?
Well, I was thinking of Samuel Anderson's student, Laura Potsdam.
Oh, yeah.
And she is a plagiarist. We didn't talk about this in this interview, but she's a plagiarist. And she is an amazing liar.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So having been a TA at multiple universities now, I can say that it just really hit home for me. I've definitely dealt with some plagiarists in my life. And, I'm always scared that they are Laura Potsdams, that there's this part of you as a teacher that gets really paranoid about these silly things, and you think, like, are they lying to me? And Laura Potsdam makes it seem like, yes, yes, they are.
30 pages of lies in this novel. Yeah. All right. Next time on Lit City, we're going to learn a little bit more about the city of literature and talk with Ethan Kanan, who is the author of The Doubter's Almanac. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Anna Williams. And you're now leaving Lit City. See
cute,
you next time.
Cute Anna.